Okay. Well, I was going to say it's a manifestation of the old proverb that a prophet is without honor in his own country. This was all in one big room in the styling showroom. We had our desks back there even. This was really quite a small department overall. We were forbidden in the most stern manner that we were not to go over and look at that model even. We were to stay back at our desks in our own territory there, which suddenly became our own territory, limited territory. And over to the side under tarps were two metal full-size models that Loewy had made in France. And we weren't supposed to see those either. We weren't supposed to lift the tarps off them.
Why not?
Although we actually did, and we hung a piece of paper over a window with a picture of Kilroy on it, and to show them that we were there. We had looked at it. I mean, we had a strike back in some way. Uh-huh. And this was getting to Ted this day. Ted Peach.
Oh, Ted Peach, of course.
And his sense of humor was vanished. He was, and I, like a fool, was sort of goading him on. I could see he was really getting angry. I'd make smart remarks to make him, not directed at him, but at the situation, you know, wry remarks. Well, it came quitting time, and Gene Harding, chief engineer, and Randy Farrow, director of styling, were seated in chairs, and they were discussing a full-size clay model of a coming facelift, the quitting bell rang, and Ted slammed on his coat, jammed his hat down over his head, and he stomped out, and he walked past where Gene and Harding and Randy were seated, and next to them was one of these aluminum type ashtrays on an aluminum pedestal, you know, with a glass removable ashtray in it. Mm-hmm. As he went past, he gave that ashtray a resounding kick, and it went rolling across this polished hardwood floor with the glass coming loose, you know, and mm-hmm. hitting a lot of inertia behind the heavy glass, and it hit a lot of things and made a lot of noise. it's the sort of thing you don't usually see in the August halls of an engineering or styling department. Startled everybody. And Ted had just he'd gone beyond the breaking point. And that was his way of showing it, I guess. And he kept on going. Randy went after him and implored him to stop and come back. Well, why should Ted, you know? He knew he'd get chewed out. So that was when Ted left Studebaker.
No volition or by request?
Well, by request, I guess. It would have been worked both ways. I mean,
he'd had it.
Yeah, so that only left myself and Randy. And Randy was afraid I was going to leave because I was a good friend of Ted's. And he implored me to came over to my house the next day and said if I had any ideas of leaving, he wanted to know about it because, you know, he was in a kind of a bad situation now.
Was he adamant about letting Ted go?
Well, I guess he felt that he couldn't trust Ted at that point. Ted had embarrassed him in front of Harding, so to say, and just as I had embarrassed Abdella Rosa in front of Dick Craffy, and although not quite in such, well, not near such drastic terms. But, people are kicked around enough, they reach their breaking point. Things went on pretty much like that, right till the bitter end, that day in early December of 63, when the flags and the plant were all flying at half staff. Officially, they were flying at half staff for Kennedy, but to us, it looked like they were flying at half staff for Studebaker.
What had happened to Egbert at this point?
Well, Egbert's health was failing, and I believe he had some serious ulcer problems.
Just developing cancer, I guess.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And he was out of the picture for, I can't remember. I would guess it would be maybe as much as a half a year.
Long period.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was no direction to the company.
Well, a man named Byers Burlingame, who was strictly an accountant.
Type. Byers Burlingame.
Do you know him?
No, I've never heard that name before.
Well, he was the...
B-Y-E-R-S-B-U-R-L-I-N-G-A-M-E.
Just like it sounds. Just like it sounds.
Who brought him in the board?
I think so.
He turned to a financial man.
Right. Well, at this point, I think their mind was made up. We didn't know it, but...
They were going to do the... They were going to give the plan.
Byers, the Burlingame was called the Undertaker in some quarters. And after the fact, maybe. But he was not an automobile man. He made no pretense of being one, and he was just doing his job. So that was the way Studebaker, from our vantage point, the way Studebaker ended.
Very sad.
It was very sad.
Could it have been avoided, do you think? Do you have any idea what could have been done to avoid it?
Well, yes. If someone had done away with Henry Ford II, maybe Studebaker and Nash might have survived, Packard, Hudson. The reason I say that is because Henry said sometime in 1953 or 4 that he was going to beat Chevrolet no matter what. He was going to be number one again.
And turned out at the expense of the independents.
And this, I'm not being original here. You'll see this quote in Burke's book, but someone said, when the elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. And Studebaker dealers couldn't sell Studebakers for $50 above invoice like Ford and Chevy dealers were being forced to do because the factory was dumping cars on them. Each one fighting for sales supremacy. So the independents were a casualty of this what was essentially an ego trip on Ford's part. I have said I'm a great admirer of Henry Ford and Edsel Ford, but I really don't feel that way about Henry II. Admittedly, Studebaker management was inept at many times. We can say that with hindsight. Well, I felt so even at the time, but I don't think they were any more so than the management of Ford or GM. But they couldn't afford to be.
Yeah, I guess it was lack of money that made them go try to go on the cheap in terms of mechanical development. In other words, make a body and a chassis as good looking as...
Well, they didn't have the money for new models.
Yeah.
Sometimes that was a blessing, but...
The engine was an ancient one.
Yeah. The engine was a virtual copy of the Cadillac. The V8 Studebaker was a Chinese copy of the Cadillac, the original Cadillac overhead valve, 49 Cadillac, scaled down to 230-some cubic inches.
The 6 dated back to the 20, didn't it?
Well, no, the 6 dated back to the Champion, which came out in 39.
Oh, okay.
The Commander 6 might have dated back to...
Okay. That's what I think.
I can't speak with authority on that. It was a good engine, but once they're going downhill and they didn't have the money for new model development, I guess the handwriting was on the wall.
I guess ramshackle would be a good
word. Yeah.
How was it mechanically?
Well, it was a good.
Yeah.
Basically good.
Yeah.
It had some little glitches in it. I have one, and the transmission linkage leaves a lot to be desired. But as far as engine reliability and frame rigidity, something they sadly lacked on the previous coupes.
Right.
But the Avanti had a good, heavy, rigid frame under it. Finally, when it was too late.
Yeah.
And it didn't have the sophisticated The suspension perhaps wasn't as sophisticated as some of the competition. Certainly not as the some of the European cars. But it was mechanically a good car.
As an American exotic, it seems to have remained high in the affection.
It has its following, yeah.
Yeah.
Most of whom are quite unhappy with the new regime at Avanti.
I heard some come up with grotesque ersatz replica cars.
Well, you know, trying to make a limousine out of a sports car is ridiculous, or a sports-oriented car.
What's your epitaph on Brooks Stevens?
He's still living.
I know. I mean, in terms of a designer, as you saw him coming at the last minute to try and request him.
Well,
bread and butter in
life. Off and on during his career, Stevens has had some competent designers working for him.
Mm-hmm.
Stevens' brand of design, especially at that time, was not mine. Okay. He liked very crisp architectural stuff,
yeah.
Angular stuff.
Yeah.
I like flowing organic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, I was much more in tune with Lowy.
Yeah. Who did have taste.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that harks back even to Gregory's days. The early Zephyrs were flowing and organic, and that's why I like them. And he did a good job of executing those cars. Extremely good job. That's why I hated to dwell on this period after 42 when I couldn't figure out what had happened. They were capable of doing much, much better.
What would be your epitaph for Studebaker, if you were asking?
Well, they made some of the most interesting, exciting cars produced in this country. It's too bad they had to go the way they did. But to a large degree, they brought it on themselves. Those coupes were a pretty poor excuse for a car, mechanically and structurally.
The Starlight.
Mainly structurally.
Starlight and Starliner 52s.
Yeah. I know. I have some of those, too.
Do you?
And we used to call it the rubber band frame without any exaggeration.
Lowy wasn't able to exercise any oversight on the mechanicals.
No. I don't think he was really that perceptive, mechanically anyway. But there were others who could have told the company what.
Other designers?
Yeah, yes. What was wrong?
Certainly Burke would have been one.
Yes, and he tells in his book where he tried to
he felt frustrated.
Sell them on a.
Yeah.
And I was harping on it,
mm-hmm.
a lot. But
yeah.
You have to, when you're, you know, you have to, you can't harp too much because you become a thorn in the side and they want to get rid of you.
Apparently, Vance and maybe Hardig. Others were oblivious to the fact that they were turning out ramshackle products with a pretty face.
Well, I don't know about Harding. I think that certainly describes Vance.
Yeah. Harding apparently tried.
I really don't know what limitations he might have had.
Yeah.
Therefore, you hate to, you know, it's easy to sit here and
sure.
condemn somebody, but. I did kind of feel we, when the subject was brought up, that you could kind of feel their spine stiffen a bit, you know, and their hackles raise,
oh,
as
yeah.
the story goes. So if you wanted to keep your job, you couldn't say too much too loudly.
Yeah.
What his reasons were, maybe he couldn't do anything, maybe he could, but. Don't underestimate the taste or the sense of the public.
No, never.
Mercedes is overpriced as it is. It's they have gotten where they were, I think, on merit.
Yeah.
Now maybe they're staying where they are on reputation, but They certainly aren't worth the money they ask for them, but they built a good solid car. People sense the solidity when they ride in a car.
Part of the German character is solidity.
Yeah.
Did you stay on to the bitter end?
I was there to the bitter end. They left, they kept a couple of engineers to make necessary changes for the Canadian operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they switched to a Chevrolet engine.
Yeah.
But there was no more styling done after that. That is, it's not quite true. If you interview Bob Marks, he'll tell you where he...
Who's that?
Bob Marks, the man I was with when we left the
party. Oh, yes. And we were going to.
Yeah. He is...
At Chrysler.
Yeah. He designed a program for a facelift for the Canadian operation.
He did.
But it never got off the ground.
What happened to the corporation? Did it disintegrate or disappear? What? Someone take over
it
the
assets? It was taken over by Worthington, I guess it was, Worthington Pump Company. And
Worthington, Ohio?
It went through so many mutations there, and I really had no interest in it, so I don't know. It still exists as there was some electrical equipment maker in there too, but...
What happened to Bob Dana, post-Studebaker?
Oh, he wanted to be his own boss, so he went to Milwaukee and bought an auto body shop.
Really?
Thought he was going to become a Pininfarina or something. He soon learned the facts of life.
Let's hear a little bit about it.
Well, I chose the wrong business in the wrong town at the wrong period at the wrong era.
Uh-huh.
It's a service industry, and the period from 65 through 82 was the period when the working man was king. He could dictate his terms, and if you didn't like his terms, you criticized, if you looked at him cross-eyed, he'd pick up his tools and go across the street, work for a dealer and make more money and do poorer work.
Uh-huh.
And there we were left hanging without a staff.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nightmare.
Really?
Mm-hmm. All 20 years of it.
Oh, 20 years?
Well, 18, I guess it was, exactly.
Did you make a living?
Barely.
And was there any satisfaction in the...
Well, sometimes, you know, I had the facilities to work on my own cars.
Uh-huh.
During that period, I, along with another tenant of the building we were in, bought the building. The building is now our principal source of income. It's a pretty nice building.
Oh.
35,000 square feet.
Wow.
And I actually live in the building.
Do you? Perfect. Yeah, great. And houses your collection as well?
Houses my collection. I like to tell visiting friends that I always wanted a house with an attached garage. So I've got a 6,000 square foot garage and a 1,000 square foot apartment.
Wow, that's great.
It's a small apartment, of course.
It fits your needs. What sort of work did you do during those 18 years?
Well, I managed this body shop. I owned the body shop.
Can you tell some of the projects you worked on that you...
Well, we tried to do high-quality work. We wound up doing...
For what type of market?
Mostly the import market.
Oh, the import market, okay.
We did all the work for the only Porsche Audi dealer, and we did a lot of work on Mercedes.
Uh-huh.
And mostly import stuff.
Were you able to get the parts from them?
Yeah, they were good on parts.
Great. So you established quite a local reputation, I suspect, among the...
Yeah, we had a good reputation. It was a nightmare keeping it, though, because...
Why? Oh, because the people couldn't...
Because of this help problem.
They just picked up as you say.
Trying to keep good help.
Yeah, and you wanted good help.
The dealers did quick and dirty work, you know, and they made big money doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So to try to compete against them for the same price...
Yeah.
And do good work and expect your men to make a living. They had a point of view too, which I appreciated.
Sure.
Well, the end of it was that they got paid pretty well, and what was left was mine, and there wasn't a heck of a lot left.
Yeah.
But we did acquire this building anyway during that period.
What street is it?
Fourth and Cherry.
Yeah. in Milwaukee, in downtown Milwaukee. And it's a desirable location as well.
It's just north of downtown, but it's before you get into the blighted area.
Oh, okay. And it's desirable and it's a good building.
Yes, very good, solid building.
Who are your tenants now?
Well, our 14,000 square foot first floor is empty, sad to say. We had a vocational school, a county supported vocational school in there when we bought the building.
Mm-hmm.
We thought they were in there for life, but
really?
They weren't.
Oh dear.
And second floor, we've got a printing operation that shares the second floor with me, uh-huh. with myself.
Yeah.
And we now have another body shop on the third floor where I had operated mine.
Oh, I see. Successful body shop?
Very successful.
Okay.
He's doing a much better job than I did.
What kind of market does he in?
Same market.
Oh, same market. Oh, good.
But he's in a better climate now.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Because
in demand now.
Around 82, we had a severe recession,
right.
brought on by the administration's efforts to tighten up on the dollar,
right.
which was the only way to cure the inflation problem. Yeah, so I'm not criticizing Reagan at all.
Yeah, no.
And well, men tend to value their jobs more now,
sure.
and
good.
Especially in Milwaukee because we've lost so much industry.
You're really going down.
We're in a depressed area.
Right. Too bad because it's a prime location.
It's a really a nice town. I like it.
And you've got a good working, supply of experienced mechanics.
Well, there's a better supply than there was. You know?
Yeah, right.
So,
well, looking back,
it's one of those cases of timing.
I understand.
Speaking of timing.
Speaking of timing, looking back in your career, got about 5 minutes. How would you sum it up? How would you like to be remembered?
I'd like to be remembered as a good designer.
Right. And one who didn't compromise.
Well, I wouldn't want to make it that hard a statement. No, you have to compromise.
Well, I don't mean that you didn't compromise, but you didn't like to make bad compromises.
Well, things should be approached from a rational viewpoint, an objective, rational viewpoint.
Right.
And above all, I'm interested in the product.
Mm-hmm. The integrity of the product.
The integrity of the product. That gets back to Henry Ford again. I think Henry Ford had, the original Henry Ford,
mm-hmm.
had integrity. He
right.
built. He put good materials in the car. Maybe some people thought he was slow to abandon so-called buggy suspension and mechanical brakes and so forth. But
he felt they had improved.
Basically, yes. There were something to be said for his suspension, too. But he put out a car with above-all integrity. And Edsel, I think, saw to it that the car had design styling integrity.
Right.
They'll always be personal heroes to me.
They're basically a good team. It's too bad they got out of sync emotionally and philosophically.
Yeah, if that's, I know that was true. Edsel I admired for his good taste in design. Some of Henry's social ideas I was more in agreement with. He might have been a little gotten a little bit carried away with paternalism toward his men in the real early days, but I think he was so embittered by the failure of that to work, that he then became a very hard-nosed employer.
Yeah, he did become embittered. He felt that benevolent paternalism was the way to go, and that employees should be loyal and should be grateful.
Yeah.
In the best sense of the word.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't even up there. He felt
yeah.
betrayed.
So I attribute a lot of his skinflint reputation of the 30s, you know, back to this disenchantment.
Right. Exactly.
Skinflint isn't the word I wanted to use. I just happened to hear somebody use that word the other day. I didn't want to argue with her.
Well, basically, are you happy with the way things turned out? Would you think you would have done something differently?
Well, I haven't given that too much thought because you can't go back.
That's bootless.
You can't turn back.
Yeah, right.
I don't think I could have stayed with Ford through the 50s.
Because Delarosa stayed there for another 10 years.
And when I saw what was coming up for the rest of the 50s, I don't think I would have stayed.
Did you have much interplay with Bourdonnais?
Well, a little bit.
What was your estimate of him?
Well, he was always friendly and civil.
Yeah.
And
but a consummate politician.
A consummate, or...
Consummate is preferred.
Is it?
Yeah.
Politician. Yeah, I, as I say, I regard him about the same as Bill Schmidt.
Yeah, right.
But he was civil and friendly and not two-faced, as I would describe Dolorosa.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Among other things.
Well,
I don't remember Bourdonnais with any, you know, feeling of bitterness or anything.
Well, it would seem that the best...
But I don't have the respect for him that I had for Gregory.
Well, it would seem that your career is, I think, a case study in
frustration.
Artistic frustration.
Yeah.
Here you are trying to make the best product you know how to do, and you're being frustrated sales trimmers.
Yeah. And I didn't want to make rocket ships. I wanted to make good-looking, practical automobiles.
Right.
So, which I think we are getting to now again, good-looking, practical automobiles. I think it's evolving toward that again. We've been forced to by aerodynamics.
Do you think that's the trend of the future, aerodynamics?
Oh, it certainly is a trend of the present, and if energy is going to be a consideration, it'll be the trend of the future. So I kind of hope we always do have a little energy shortage cloud hanging over us. It'll force us to design sensible automobiles instead of those monstrosities that were produced in the 50s and 60s.
Any final word?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. David.